Hello and welcome back to what's probably the last of the episodes of Challenger City TO in this little tranche. Really, we've loved exploring big, bold ideas, talking to interesting, innovative, creative people when it comes to how we think about the future of Toronto, especially from not the perspective of your classical urbanist. And for the last one, we sort of saved it for a really big topic, which is housing. So today, the guest is Chris Spoke. He's a partner at the real estate developer Toronto Standard. He's super passionate for smart urban development. He's got a really interesting background. He's been involved in the world of software development. Now he's getting into this sort of highly regulated arena of real estate. And really what he does is share his insights on the challenges and opportunities that Toronto faces today. There's loads of issues, but Chris is really, really positive on the future of Toronto. He's very heavily invested in this city. And he believes that there's the potential to overcome lots of these current obstacles. So we'll be talking about everything from the impact of zoning laws on our city's growth to the design of family-friendly housing and what it will really take for the city to live up to its potential. So enjoy this one. Love to get your comments, your feedback, and see what we can then turn this into. So thank you very much. And without further ado, here is a conversation with Chris Spoke. So Chris, thank you so much for being the sort of last voluntold person into this thing.
Sure.
I really want to talk to you today a bit about sort of Toronto, a bit about housing, because you're doing stuff in that space. I know you do some other cool stuff around like making this city a better place to live. But to get us going, like, let's get the introduction to you as this guy who owns a great development agency, is building housing. I'll let you do it in your own words.
Yeah. So what I mostly work on now is I'm a partner in a real estate development firm called Toronto Standard. We do a few things, but our focus is on building and owning for the long-term rental properties in Toronto. So we have a few of these projects that we're pursuing now. These are all kind of like slow-moving projects, especially relative to software, which I've done for the last 15 years. But yeah, I'm a real estate developer with a couple of partners, and our plan is to build and own rental property in the city that we believe in the long-term prospects for Toronto. So we want to just kind of contribute our efforts to that.
What got you into it? What led you down that path?
Yeah, I think a pretty non-traditional path. I have no real estate education or experience. A lot of people who end up in development either get to it through municipal law or urban planning or even finance, none of which I've studied or worked in. I used to work, as I mentioned, in software. And I got really interested in land use planning, more so as kind of like a public policy thing. So kind of like what you're doing now, which is like exploring what it is that makes Toronto great, what stands in its way in terms of, you know, obstacles to being greater still. And around 2017, 2018, I started looking into this like issue of rising housing prices and trying to understand what contributed to it. And that sent me down the path of urban land use planning and all these constraints that the municipal government puts on housing development. And through that process, I just got familiar with the industry. And then, you know, there was a point at which I thought I was talking a lot about the issue. I'd like to contribute more than just, you know, more talk. And that's when I got into real estate development as a profession.
Love that. And like in terms of as you learned about that as a sort of amateur, and now I think we can call you professional because you're doing it for a living.
Yeah.
Like what was the biggest thing that stood out to you, or what was the sort of shocking point or the big learning moment for you?
Well, again, having come from the world of software, working for startups and digital agencies and that sort of thing, where you don't really need permission to do things, like maybe the one bottleneck or like gatekeeper might be like the Apple Store, where I used to work for an agency called Plastic Mobile that developed a lot of mobile apps for big Canadian brands. And we'd have to submit our apps to the App Store for review and approval to be published in the App Store. That's like a 3-4 day process that is pretty predictable. We understand that if we're not doing anything crazy, we're going to get approved. But when digging into what it takes to build housing, it's like a whole different world where at every step of the way, there's a lot of regulation, there's a lot of legislation, and there are a lot of people that need to sign off on your efforts. So the veto points along the way are like, there's a lot of them. And it's like the most permissioned industry, maybe the most regulated industry that at least I've come across. And, you know, if you buy into this general relationship between supply and prices, so that, you know, if you build more of something, prices generally come down. If you don't build enough of it, generally prices go up. Like all these veto points, all these regulations, all these gatekeepers are probably contributing in a meaningful way to prices being so high.
And I think like housing, the two dinner topics that I want Toronto to never talk about again.
Sure.
Traffic and transit and housing. Like, we talk about housing all the time. And like, talking about your house is a wonderful thing when you're talking about maybe something you've done at home or something that makes your place a better place to live. But talking about not being able to afford a home completely sucks.
It does. I mean, the reason why people talk about it so much, again, I got into this issue in 2017, 2018, and I think I was a little early to it. Like now it's all that people can talk about to the point where, like you said, maybe it's getting tiresome, but because it is probably the biggest issue facing, especially young people or new immigrants or people who are starting families and need more space. Like you don't, I hear you, you don't want every conversation you have to be one like about complaints, but you know, to the extent that we live in Toronto and we love Toronto, I think, yeah, housing and probably transit and transportation and congestion are the two big things we got
to
fix.
In terms of like Toronto, when it comes to housing, like you look at the skyline, that it is transformed over 30 years from being relatively flat to now condos galore. I'd argue a lot of those condos are not necessarily like the right housing that we want. And we probably see that with condo prices under pressure just now. There's only so many 1 and 2 bedroom boxes in the sky. But like from where you've seen it, like what's Toronto struggling with when it comes to housing? Is it just a matter of being able to have things zoned in the right way and get permissions in a quick manner? Like what's the sort of biggest challenges that you see as a developer, basically?
Yeah, so if you look at the skyline from like Toronto Islands, it looks like there's been a ton of development over the last 30 years, and there certainly has been. But if you take a more like bird's eye view of the city, what you'll notice is that all of this development has been really concentrated downtown with little pockets, maybe in Midtown, Parkland, and Lakeshore. There's these other nodes of growth. But other than those pockets, the rest of the city has stayed pretty much the same for the last 50 years, where it's like detached or semi-detached houses, 1 or 2 stories. And that's how it's been since the 60s and the 70s, or since whenever those homes were first built. And there was actually a study that was conducted that showed that over half of Toronto's land area has actually seen a decline in density and a decline in population over the last 50 years, which is not what you would expect given the demand pressures of all these people moving to the country and to the city. So we have this bifurcated market where on one hand, in these small nodes, relatively small nodes just by land area, you're allowed to build a lot and you're allowed to build really tall. And then everywhere else, you're allowed to build pretty much nothing. And this is starting to change, but like that has been the case for a long time. The relevant policy documents that govern Toronto's land use are the city's official plan and zoning bylaw. And the language in the city, in the official plan, is that any development in these neighborhoods must respect and reinforce the existing physical character of those neighborhoods. So like the policy objective is one of stagnation or a minimum stability where like change is not permitted. And I think like we are in a kind of like weird moment in time market-wise, but on a longer time horizon, I think that is the biggest obstacle to us building enough housing. It's that just legally in most of the city, it's literally not permitted to build the amount of housing that you might expect in a city that's growing as rapidly as ours is.
I find it so weird because I live on Bloor, just northwest of High Park, and I'm in a 9-story building, lovely rooftop. But whenever I have friends over and we'll go up to the roof, you look sort of towards downtown and it's just a sea of trees and you don't really actually see any housing. And then suddenly you get to probably like Bathurst and then stuff sprouts up and everyone's always shocked to see it because like Toronto is a much greener city than you realize, but it's also like it really puts into perspective that lack of density outside of the downtown.
I think where it's most stark is if you look at, again, like a aerial photo of Yonge Street, let's say north of the 401, you'll see all these towers and mid-rise buildings lining along Yonge Street, and then immediately behind them is, as far as the eye can see, like detached bungalows. Almost where it feels like a Potemkin city, where like on Yonge Street, you'd feel like you're in a big city with like dense housing. And then immediately behind it, none of that. There are a lot of these examples. Like Yonge and Eglinton is this node where you have really high density housing within like a 16 block radius. Then immediately adjacent to that, again, it's like a sea of detached bungalows as far as the eye can see. And it's not that like market forces have made that so. It's that the land use planning is very different on one side of the street than it is on the other. So we've had a land use planning regime that frankly has been to the benefit of these homeowners in these low-rise neighborhoods who moved into their neighborhoods when they looked a certain way and want them to remain that way, where all the growth has been forced into these small pockets so that they could, you know, maintain the stability and the character of their neighborhoods. And I think we're probably getting to a breaking point. And we could talk a little bit, if you want, about how that's starting to change, but it's only very recently starting to change.
Yeah, I'd love to talk about that because it's interesting. Since doing this, I've had a few people get in touch with me and say, I would love to help. I want your help for me to challenge Toronto's plans to change the zoning. And I'm like, You're talking to the wrong guy, because I want us to build like 4, 5, 6 story stuff everywhere. I don't want to protect what we have today. Like, it's nice enough, but we're not going to tear up your houses, but we're going to change the way like much of the existing city looks. And it's going to take a long time and multi-generations to get there. So I'd love to talk about that, because it feels slow to me.
It is very slow. I mean, there's this like slow pace of policy change and changing political opinions. And then even when that policy change happens, there's like the slow pace of real estate development. So all of this is very slow. What I'd recommend to the people reaching out to you to somehow get involved, there's an organization called More Neighbors Toronto, which is called like a YIMBY, Yes in My Backyard organization. And that term, that acronym YIMBY, stands in contrast to the idea of NIMBYs, people who don't want to see any change or development anywhere near their backyards. So More Neighbors Toronto is an organization that does a lot of good work in terms of pushing for more, you know, call it progressive housing policy. And like, as part of those efforts, or let's say some of those efforts have started to bear fruit. And I mentioned that some of this policy is starting to change. So one big example of that is in spring of 2023, so just last year, Toronto passed the multiplex bylaw that made it so that on any residential lot, anywhere in the city, you could build a multiplex of up to 3 stories with up to 4 units. And this is like pretty unprecedented, because this goes very clearly against this directive to have any new development respect and reinforce the existing physical character. So I think it's insufficient as policy change. Like, we'll need to go much further than that, but it does signal a major shift in terms of how planning thinks about housing and planning and growth, where it's no longer about like protecting the old and more so about preparing for the new or something like that.
Where do you see it going over time in terms of, it's very early, but are you starting to see developments or developers be like, oh, we can now do this in these places? Or is it still sort of too early to tell the impact it's going to have?
Yeah, I think like the policy is definitely moving in the right direction, but the way these policies are designed is often that they're over-designed. So it's not just that like you can now build 3 stories and like the rest is up to you. The city and city planning specifically gets extremely prescriptive when it comes to things like minimum front yard setbacks, side yard setbacks, maximum building depths, lot coverage, all these other things that like layer on these constraints, whether or not, you know, 3 stories, 4 units is permitted. So I think the direction is generally good, but it's still overprescribed, and overprescribed usually to the point where development of a certain scale might be legal in theory, but it's not feasible in practice. And I think bridging that gap is going to take a few more rounds of like the city implementing relatively good policy, but like overdoing it. And then 4 years later, conducting a study and then wondering, hey, what, we legalized multiplexes. Why are we not seeing more multiplexes being built? And identifying those parts of the policy that have maybe gone too far and paring them back and liberalizing. So it'll certainly move like slower than the crisis would require it move. But, you know, at least, you know, to the extent that we're looking to not just complain about this, it's moving in the right direction.
Yeah. I don't know if Toronto's done this. I don't think it has, but it's the thing around staircases, right? Because one of the things that makes it hard to build those buildings is when you have this requirement to have 2 staircases, because it takes up so much space.
That's right. So this is a building code issue. So Canada, or I'll say Ontario specifically, because it's the Ontario Building Code, is the second most strict in the world, next to Uganda, in terms of at what level is a second point of egress, so a second staircase required. In Canada, and certainly in Ontario, as soon as you go above 2 stories, you need a second staircase. And that on larger sites, if you're building kind of like a motel-sized 2, 3-story, 4-story apartment, that's probably fine. When you're building tight infill projects in a city like Toronto, so we have one of these that's 4 stories on a 23-foot-wide lot. That second staircase requirement, which introduces like a scissor stair configuration, it could take up like up on some of our floors, more than half of our floor plate is just egress. It's just staircase. And this was a requirement that was introduced in like the 1940s. We've made a lot of progress since then in other alternative fire safety measures like sprinkler systems, like better fire rated materials, but we've not revisited this one rule despite the rest of the developed world being more permissive on it. So there's all these like small technical things like that sound like they might not make a big difference, but practically they do. So again, this is something that the province has committed to updating. BC has committed to updating in their provincial building code. The federal government has committed to updating the national code in this direction. It's not yet happened, but at least the discussions are moving in the right direction.
Yeah. It's interesting because there's certain cities that you go to and you'll go and see the types of things that have been built. And I kind of pick on Williamsburg in New York as like a quite nice example of this, because 20 years ago, it was kind of slightly derelict. 15 years ago, people started putting new buildings in. 10 years ago, it like was cool. 7 years ago, I moved away from there and it was just nice. It was no longer cool because I lived there. And if you go back there now, there's all these really interesting infill buildings between, you've got the sort of super block condos that tend not to be much more than 6 or 8 stories.
Yeah.
But you have these really interesting little things that almost look like faintly Japanese that they've kind of squeezed in. But I'm sure to do that has required, like, there's a certain sense of constraint drives innovation, but the spatial constraint drives that innovation, not necessarily the regulatory constraint drives that innovation.
Yeah, I think it's a bit of both. So Manhattan and Brooklyn, New York generally, benefited from hitting a lot of its growth stride before zoning got really aggressive and restrictive, which happened sometime around the 60s and 70s in most of the Anglosphere. Toronto has hit its growth stride really since like 2000, so well past the time of really restrictive zoning. So in New York, for example, the idea of a side yard setback, of having like to leave space between the sidewall and your property line, that's just not a thing because land is scarce and valuable. And why would you just have a side yard? Like, there's no practical purpose for it. So there's like the physical constraint of narrow lots, but there's not the additional regulatory constraint of a side yard setback. Whereas in Toronto, because we, again, are like a Potemkin city with like an urban downtown, but a suburban rest of the city. Even recently this year, we passed what was called the major streets policy, which permits apartment buildings of up to 6 stories on the city's major streets. And even within this policy, it requires a 2.4 meter side yard setback. And it's like, why are we requiring the side yard setback? And the explanation is that is how you maintain the existing pattern of there being side yard setbacks. So there are physical constraints that could drive creativity. But in Toronto, what we've done is added these additional regulatory constraints. And it's one thing for them to drive creativity, but often what they do is they just kill the viability of these projects, so they just don't get built.
The irony is we're doing all of that at a point when immigration is high. We're trying to like help more people live here. We're trying to make it more affordable. So we're sort of making one step of progress and then like sort of shooting ourselves in the foot at the same time.
Yeah, there's this misalignment in terms of policy between the federal government on immigration and then municipal government in terms of land use planning. But there's also, I think, a misalignment in terms of people's value sets, where a lot of Toronto homeowners think of themselves as quite progressive and open to immigration, including high levels of immigration, and generally like not MAGA, build the wall type people. But that attitude does not extend to their neighborhood, where actually mm-hmm. they do want to build a wall around their neighborhood, and that wall is regulatory. It's like, we could accept as many immigrants as we can handle, as long as they don't require apartment buildings in my neighborhood. That's like a bridge too far. And I think that misalignment, disconnect, hypocrisy, whatever you want to call it, needs to be resolved for us to like fix this issue.
Yeah, it's fascinating that sort of there's a little bit of two-facedness when it comes to Toronto as a city of like, oh, it's always been like this way, so we want to keep it like that. But we're really proud that we're not those people south of the border.
That's right.
Meanwhile, the Americans are like actually quite open to immigration and they build the housing for immigrants. And it's mostly one loud man with bad hair that sort of kicking up a fuss. So, and it's the people who are not influenced by the immigrants that vote for him. So
that's right. Like red states that are like strong, like let's call them Trump supporting states, often have much more permissive land use rules and allow for much more housing development than we do. So yeah, there is this kind of like weird, I don't know, cross-partisan thing where it's not obvious like which side of the spectrum is more pro-growth than the other.
Yeah. And what, like for you, when you see it as like you're trying to build these buildings, what's the biggest headache for you effectively?
Yeah, so we like to skate where the puck is going from like a legislation and regulation standpoint. So we really leaned into this multiplex policy. We're now really leaning into this major streets policy. There are ways in which I think the policy could be improved, but we do to some extent take the policy as it's given. And we have to, like, as you mentioned, work within those constraints. So right now it's just like practical real estate development things, like trying to find sites at the right price that work for our pro forma, trying to find construction managers who could engage with sub trades at the right price to work within our pro forma. So like there's this big policy thing, and that's a, like, I came to this business with that interest, but like there's a lot of just like practical, like the numbers have to work for the development to work sort of thing.
Yeah. And like when you were thinking about building these kind of things, a thing that I've sort of picked upon when it comes to like especially the big condos, and we've had a couple of people talk about, we've not created a downtown or we've not created an urban environment really where you can actually raise a family here. We've sort of gone, you're a young person, you're single, here's a studio condo for you downtown. Oh, you've met a partner, you have a boyfriend or a girlfriend, or you've just got married, here's a one bedroom, maybe a one plus den. And then it's you're like thinking about having children, getting like sort of growing your family. Well, your choice is, have you got enough money to buy detached somewhere in the city, or see you later, it's off to Etobicoke or Mississauga for you, or Scarborough or wherever. But like, we push these people out.
Sure.
Are you finding are you thinking about what's the type of unit that you build? Do you build a unit differently?
So this is like an area that I'm very interested in. I have a young family myself. I've got 3 kids. I love living in Toronto. I don't want to move to the burbs. And I like not just that I have a family, but I like it when there are lots of families and young kids in cities. I think that cities becoming like a playground for people in their early 20s is like fine. We want that too, but we don't just want that. I think that cities should be open and welcome to people at all stages of life. And it is kind of quite striking where if you go to, like, for example, Trinity Bellwoods Park in Toronto, and then if you go the next day to like an equivalent size park in Mississauga, the like variety in demographics, in age groups in Mississauga will be like much greater than what you'll see at Trinity Bellwoods, where everyone's between the ages of like, I don't know, 23 and 43 or something like that, and very few kids. I think it's too bad that the city has become so unwelcoming to young families. So I think a large part of this is you just need housing to be more affordable. So there's this like housing abundance thing that you can't get around. There are design things you can implement that make housing more family friendly, like the units more family friendly. But I think to begin with, you just need housing to be more abundant and more affordable. That's kind of like step one. But then there are these things, again, like we talked about the single egress or dual egress requirement past 3 stories. If you think about a lot of European apartment buildings or condos in the like 6 to 8 story range, what you'll often see is what are called point access blocks. Well, they'll have one staircase with like an elevator next to it. And then on every floor, there might be like 4 to 6 units that have access to that one staircase and that one elevator. Whereas in Toronto, we build a lot more of what we call double loaded corridors. And it's so different from Europe that Europe thinks of these buildings as like hotels, where you have like a staircase on one end of a hallway, a staircase at another end, an elevator core in the middle, and you have this long corridor. And what that produces practically is units that are much narrower and much deeper than what you might get in a point access block. And those just aren't nice livable spaces, and certainly not nice livable spaces for families. So I think you need to solve this problem of just making housing more available and affordable. But we also have these like design things and these code requirements that make it so that the housing that we are able to produce is, like, to your point, geared more so to like one bed plus den, usually investor driven product.
It's interesting. I stayed in this Airbnb in Yerevan in Armenia last year. And there's one of those places, I arrived at 3 in the morning. It looked like it was a weird sort of Soviet communist block of apartments. I was like, oh, am I being scammed here? Like, what the hell have I got myself into? Super sketchy lift elevator to get up to the apartment. But it was built like that. It was sort of you had all these units sort of congregated on a stairwell and an elevator. And then a bit further along, it was like, it wasn't necessarily everyone came in through the same entrance, but it felt, arriving at 3 a.m. in the dark with a hell of a lot of prejudice, it felt weird. But actually, when you saw it in the daytime, you're like, hang on, this contributes to a much more sort of family-oriented series of apartments. And I admit that it's in Armenia, but I think that's interesting as a precedent.
Yeah, well, and even on the point of elevators, so in Europe, generally, it often costs about a quarter to build an elevator in a small apartment building than it does in North America. So that if you have like 3-4 story apartment buildings in like this 4-story one that we're building in Toronto, you almost certainly will not have an elevator. Whereas in Europe, you would have an elevator. And if you think about like one of the things that makes a unit more family friendly is an elevator so that you could put your stroller in the elevator and not carry it up 3 flights of stairs. Like that's an important consideration. Never mind the accessibility consideration. So like there are code things that we've put in place that make family friendly housing much harder and more expensive to build.
Why is that? It's really weird that you would expect it would be cheaper to have an elevator in North America than you think it would be to do it in Europe.
So there's an interesting report by a think tank called the Center for Building in North America. I believe it's by a guy named Stephen Smith, who's extremely smart on these code issues. The big reason is there are basically 2 standards for manufacturing elevators. One applies to Canada and US, and the other applies to the rest of the world, like as is often the case with these things. And the rest of the world just builds many, many more elevators than we do. Most of Canada and most of the US are bungalows. Like it's a little bit different in Toronto, of course, but most of North America is bungalows where, of course, elevators are not needed. So if you're a manufacturer of elevators or elevator parts in like Shenzhen, China, and you have to pay $500,000 to license according to one standard or another, almost always you will license to the standard, the global standard, not the North American standard, which just means it's a much more competitive market and has much better pricing. And then there's a second consideration that accessibility requirements in North America are often more stringent. So in a North American elevator, a new North American elevator, you need to be able to roll in a gurney. You need to be able to fit a full gurney in an elevator and be able to spin it and it fits in the elevator. Whereas in Europe, as long as you're sitting in a wheelchair, sitting upright and spin it, that's fine. So our elevators are also generally much larger than they are. And you would think that this is good for accessibility in North America, but what happens in practice is we just have fewer elevators, more walk-up apartments, which of course is bad for accessibility. So I think, you know, an easy fix would be adopt the European standards on accessibility and on elevator manufacturing. And like overnight, we'd have a major change in how many elevators make it to new development.
Do you see much of these kind of niggly regulations? It doesn't really feel like there's just one that's really the killer.
No.
But it's the combination of them together. Do you see these fading away? Do you, given we're making tentative steps to allow greater density and infill or on like major streets, do you think we're making progress on these things too?
I think the appetite is growing for reform in this direction. I think the problem is exactly that. There are no silver bullets here. You need like to change 100 things to like really start seeing an impact in the real world. And these things are very technical and have their own political constituencies that have led to them being a certain way. And you need to be able to take all of that on. So you need enough conviction and enough passion for this issue to want to do that. And I think we're starting to see the conviction and the passion, but not often the technical expertise, which is also required to really understand this. So I think there's this general trend that, you know, especially through like long periods of peace, developed countries just keep adding complexity to their legislation and their regulation. It's never like cutting things back. It's always adding to them. And I think we're at this point where there are diminishing returns, like radical diminishing returns to complexity. And what you need to do is like reform these things individually and as a whole, but with an eye to like, we just need to simplify. We just need to like cut probably like 30, 40, 50% of this out and like reimagine this from a first principles approach to like what would smart housing policy look like.
I think it's always interesting with like the Canadian system of federal, provincial, municipal. And then like to me, Ontario, it's like the province and the city are slightly at odds because the needs of one are quite different to the other. So we end up having a city that becomes run a bit like a suburb. And then we have a city that's kind of run by, like, I don't want to be mean to politicians, but like, they're mostly quite passionate amateurs. So you'll see something like, I was watching a thing on transit and the councillor who's sitting on it is asking questions. And it's like, I can tell you haven't ridden transit in a while because that's not actually how it works. You've got the wrong understanding. And clearly the person cares because they're giving up their time. I know they get paid for it, but they've decided this is what I want to spend my time doing. So I don't want to badmouth the politician, but like that system of sort of almost like talented amateurs or passionate amateurs feels like that doesn't necessarily drive change. But on the flip side, I could see how, okay, you don't have the technical expertise. If you do and listen to the go and listen to the people who do, how do we go and make some quite sweeping changes there? So I don't know if I'm optimistic for that or not. I'm curious for your take.
I mean, I recognize this problem. I see it often on these major streets buildings that we build. There was originally proposed a 30-unit cap. So you could build up to 6 stories, but only 30 units. A counselor that I have a good relationship with proposed that this cap be increased to 60 units so that this form of development would be more viable on more lots in more parts of the city. So again, 6 stories, but now 60 units. So it might be a wider building or whatever. And after 4 or 5 hours of debate at the Planning and Housing Committee, another counselor, another city counselor who's been a counselor for many years, I think like over 20 years, raised her hand and said, so if we increase the cap from 30 to 60 units, are you telling me that we're now going to have 12-story buildings? Like the difference in like height and unit cap was lost on her, despite being a counselor for 20 years, being a member of the Planning and Housing Committee that sets housing policy. So this is like amateur hour stuff. So I recognize what you're saying and I don't have a good solution to it. I think probably then the like bureaucracy layer of government just needs to be better paid and more competent maybe. One thing that might move us a bit in that direction is it used to be that a lot of the senior members of the bureaucracy, the chief planner and so on, had to be selected and approved by council as a whole, or at least a majority vote. Now we have what are called strong mayor powers in Toronto, so that the mayor can unilaterally like hire someone that in Olivia Chow's case, she thinks is fit. And it might be that like if you need less consensus, if these decisions can be made more unilaterally, it maybe opens up more space for just hiring the best person and not the person that appeals to all these different constituency groups. So I'm optimistic that maybe we'll start seeing some better talent in government.
There's an aspect of sort of sober decision making, I think, that happens in Toronto that like there's this sort of great story, and I don't know if it's true or not, but like the Persians effectively before they would make decisions like in the fifth century BC or something, was they would discuss something sober. And then they would get drunk and discuss it again. And after they'd cleared off the hangover, they would be like, right, the sober decision was this, the drunken decision was this, therefore they match, therefore they're a good decision. I'm not suggesting this is how we run Toronto's council, by like just cracking a few bottles of whiskey and talking about the thing over again. But it often seems to be the situation where it's we don't really want somebody to lose out. So in the interest of, we kind of like, worry about what's the worst possible thing that can happen here. Let's make sure that doesn't happen. But we prioritize that over the here's the best possible thing for the most number of people that will have a huge impact. I think that's the sort of weird contradiction that the city has for lots of things, but especially housing is a good example.
Yeah. And I think one of the reasons for that is that if you build a lot of new housing, the people who it will benefit are often people who don't yet live in the city, who are not yet of age to live on their own, who might not even be born, right? These are like transformational changes to parts of the city that will benefit the city for 100, 200 years. Whereas the harms are felt by existing residents who have more shadows on their backyards, more traffic on their street, more competition for like on-street parking and that sort of thing. So it's like, even though this might benefit, call it 1 million future residents, it'll harm 100,000 current residents. From a utilitarian standpoint, like that's a very easy decision to make. But politically, those 100,000 vote today. Those million do not vote today. So like we go with the 100,000.
Yeah. It's always interesting looking at the mayors around the world that are doing things that are kind of unpopular.
Yeah.
And some of them are quite clever about it. They kind of know it'll pay off by the time it comes around to re-election again.
Yeah.
We don't really do that.
We don't do that. And I don't even think we recognize like the wisdom in that. There's like one clear example, congestion pricing, right? The idea of like tolling roads is extremely unpopular. And there's been empirical research conducted on this where like its unpopularity peaks just before it's enacted. And as soon as it's enacted, the popularity starts increasing. People start recognizing the benefit of like not always being stuck in traffic. So some of these things you just have to do despite the current public polling, knowing it's the right decision, knowing frankly that some voters don't know what they're talking about, and just like give yourself enough time before maybe your re-election for some of the benefits to start being more obvious. And I wish we would see more of that.
It's interesting. I heard a rumor that Toronto got really close to tolling the Gardner early in Tory's reign, and then like the province was against it. But back then it was like a Liberal province in charge. And it's sort of interesting that like they almost managed to do it, but then they didn't quite do it. And then New York, like Manhattan was another example a few weeks ago, literally just about to happen and then got cold feet and pulled it back. So it definitely resonates.
You need someone to either recognize the wisdom, as you mentioned, of doing these things earlier in their mandate so that by the time re-election comes around, like the pain is not as severe and the benefits are more obvious, or maybe and/or you need someone who's also just interested in doing the right thing, whether or not it's politically popular, and like, you know, maybe someone who has enough going on in their life where they're happy being premier for like one or two terms and they'll go do something else if they lose an election because they did a good and important thing that was unpopular.
Yeah. And maybe they don't even get the credit for it. Maybe it's like the mayor that's in power afterwards that sees it come to fruition, even if they might have been against it beforehand, like whatever, it's going to be for the best.
But that would be true public service, right? Like these politicians like to call themselves public servants, but they're all often like primarily concerned with their own reelection. Like a true public servant would just do good stuff.
Yeah. Oh, well, we can dream.
Yeah, right.
Where do you think Toronto goes from here? So like moving forward, what do you think will look like in a few years' time? Do you think we're on the track to some change?
I think we are on the track to some change. If we like focus on those two issues you mentioned, housing and traffic, transit, congestion, whatever, like the two things that people complain about, let's bucket that second one as mobility. I think we're making good progress on both. I think, again, we're seeing this policy change municipally that's directionally correct, if not perfect, which is, you know, fine. we're seeing more and more pressure being put on the provincial government to do more. The provincial government has promised to do a lot, has not done so much, but the political pressure is growing. And then we have almost like a competition among the federal parties on who will be best on this question of housing. So like, I'm starting to see more political will. Now we just need to see some follow through. And then on mobility, like one of the big things Toronto lacks for its size is just like subway lines. And we're building a few large subway lines. We're building the Ontario line. We're building the Yonge North extension. We've just, I think, completed the Finch West LRT. We're hopefully some point in our lifetime is going to complete the Eglinton LRT. So like we are making historical investments in transit. We spend too much on this stuff and it takes too long, again, relative other parts of the world. But like we're at least doing something. We spent like 20, 30 years in Toronto not building any new transit. At least we're now building. So I think that like there's a lot to worry and even complain about, but I do think that the trend is generally positive, and I'm a big fan of Toronto, and I'm betting big on Toronto professionally, personally, and any other way.
I think we're coming out the dip, to be honest.
Yeah, I think so.
And I think it's like, this is something, this sort of interesting thing of, it's very easy to go and bash how expensive and late and badly done the Eglinton line is, but then like, other things are like the shovels are in the ground, they're progressing. Hopefully they'll be on time and on budget, even if that budget is too high, but it's like a momentum thing. And if we can build that momentum with like building housing, building transit, and then like also just getting better with the stuff we already have.
Yeah.
I think that's massive.
We should just like not spend a year either passing good housing policy or building a kilometer or more of subway infrastructure. We should always just incrementally improve. And like where we really get hurt is when we spend a decade doing none of that. And I think, you know, to your point, I think one of the ways that you appreciate Toronto is when you travel. Like it's easy to complain about our shortcomings when you're here, but when you travel, you do, I think, like miss all the things that do make Toronto great. And we just need to like solve these important problems.
I think Toronto has a ton of great stuff. It's interesting. I talk about this with my wife of like, if we left, where would we move to and what would we need? And like during the pandemic, we left and we went to Kelowna. It was cool. Great year. Awesome snowboarding. Awesome time on like the water. But there's only so many times you can go out for the same place for dinner that shut the kitchen shuts at 8 o'clock on a Wednesday night. And Toronto, we have all this amazing stuff. In some cases, it's just about joining up again. And then there's other times you go to other places and you're like, oh my God, I wish if we had the transit system that this place had, if we built housing that this place had, just think how amazing Toronto would be. So it's like that perpetual situation of here's how we can get a lot better, but actually we need to be like thankful of what we already have. It's then how do we do more with it? I think that's the big thing for Toronto in the future.
Yeah. I think of the city as like a 7-foot basketball player who can't dunk. It's like all the potential in the world and you just need to like learn how to dunk. And that's much better than being like a 5-foot basketball player or something like that.
Yeah. Someone who should be a jockey, but is desperate to play in the NBA.
Yeah. We've got the potential. We've got like, I mean, Toronto's restaurant scene is maybe as good as it's ever been. There's a lot of like really cool stuff happening. They just like, rapid growth and just large city stuff generally, like the cracks are very obvious. So it's just about like, I guess, fixing those gaps.
So like, let's say, I know you're very passionate about the sort of like the policy and the politics side of things. But let's say you were in charge. Let's say you're the strong mayor. We're not even going to go down the magic wand route just for now. What would you do differently?
Yeah, I think I would take these two documents that I mentioned, the official plan and the zoning bylaw. I would probably combine them. There's no need to have two documents saying often many of the same things. And I would make it much more permissive to build the sort of housing that you see, you know, let's say throughout Brooklyn, you mentioned in Toronto, like the way that cities have naturally grown and developed historically before aggressive zoning is they've gone from like cabins in the woods to maybe cottages in a field to detached houses to semi-detached to townhouses to walk-up apartments. And we've basically halted that process through zoning. And then you make this leap from like, I could assemble 7 detached houses and build a 40-story tower on it. And we've skipped all these like these steps of development in between. So I would just pare these documents way back, make them much more permissive. I would appoint a new chief planner who is philosophically aligned with implementing that. So those are the big things I would do on housing. And then on transit, I guess I would do whatever I could to help Metrolinx in the province accelerate the pace of construction of these subway lines that we have. I would take another crack at congestion pricing, but probably get smacked down by the province again, as John Tory was.
There's something interesting as I reflect, as I talk through with you, and it may even have been you that I saw share this piece, but it was a few weeks ago, and it was basically this argument, I think it was using the UK as the sort of example, but saying the UK is actually a developed nation that is still developing. And it's kind of playing a bit of catch up. And instead of like most of those things that you talk about, they're things that we can do today and have been able to do for a while. It's not radical, cutting edge innovation stuff. It's making the most of what we really have. And I think that's really interesting.
Like the solutions, especially on the housing side, I think on mobility, it's harder because you actually need to dig tunnels and do hard things. On the housing side, from a policy standpoint, you literally just need to update paperwork. Like that's it. And then like the private market, we have a pretty developed and large and experienced construction and development industry. Like they'll do what they do. You just need to like update the paperwork. So, which makes it, I guess, like you could be hopeful that like the solution set is obvious and available, but it's also frustrating that like this easy, obvious thing has not yet been done, at least to like the degree that we need it to be done. So
I think the same is true for transit. I like look at streetcar lines and just like, just give me one streetcar line. Like the let me fix the switches in the tracks.
Sure.
Let me get the cars out of the way. Like I'm not going to be anti-car. I just want to be anti-car on one street. And then it's like having a free subway line across the city while we're also digging a tunnel for an expensive one. Like the both of those things would be great.
I have this pet thing around like we're building so much, there's so much development. We could probably move a lot of on-street parking below grade. I think probably over time we just need less parking overall. But the idea that we have on-street parking on like Bloor Street is pretty like crazy. It's a pretty crazy use of like valuable street space.
It's wild. I think I was riding a bike down college the other day and it feels slightly chaotic of where there's nice bike lane and suddenly it ends and sticks you into like parked cars and a streetcar. And you're like, there's a little bit of that voice in the back of your head that goes, I definitely checked behind me. Am I good? And like your heart rate goes up a little bit as you sort of merge in. It's like, it's someone who's parked the car in front of a detached house that has like you could literally park it in front of the house, but whatever.
Yeah. Again, a lot of this is like trying to prepare for the future in a way that does not disrupt any of like the incumbents. And like, I think at some point you just need to do the right thing for the future.
Yeah. So what I like to end on is like the sort of magic wand thing. So we've had you as the sort of strong mayor/benevolent dictator. What would be the thing that's maybe a bit more out there of like magic wand to make Toronto a Challenger city?
Well, let me understand the parameters of the magic wand. Do I have to like consider costs or, I don't know, like technical feasibility, or could I really just do anything?
Anything you want.
So if I have to pick one, I would like to replace the Gardner with a Boston style big dig tunnel, let's say from the DVP all the way out to like at least Jameson, if not South Kingsway. It would unlock a lot of land downtown for housing development, but it would also like end this separation of the downtown from the waterfront. And Toronto is a city on a lake, and I don't think we make good enough use of our waterfront. So if we could somehow bury the Gardner, I don't think you could eliminate it altogether. I have in-laws in the east end of the city that I visit every week, and like I could just imagine having to go there without the Gardner. But if we could somehow bury it in a way that made any sense financially, I think that would be a huge unlock for the city.
I saw this amazing idea that I don't know if it was genius or stupidity, but it was like building this arched bridge out into the harbor and basically like using that as like the Gardner. So the Gardner would turn into a grand boulevard and this sort of beautiful arched bridge around the harbor would be like the bypass.
Sure.
And it's like one of those things of like, yeah, totally magic wand. I don't know if it'd be good, but yeah, like that's the sort of thinking we don't always have.
I also like the idea of putting it underground because you just get like the cars and the noise and the pollution out of sight. A smaller one, which is much easier to implement, would be a bridge to the islands. The islands are like this amazing amenity that we have as a city. And I think that there's just a lot of friction to accessing them through the ferries. So if we could put a bridge to the islands, I think that would be relatively easy and cheap and practical to do. You don't actually need a magic wand. You just need someone to decide to do it. And I think that would be pretty cool.
I'd be a big fan of that. There's only so many sugar boats that we have to like get into the harbor every year. So what, like, I'm sure we can work around that.
I think so. Yeah.
Chris, I could talk to you all day on this, but like, I really appreciate just getting your take on like, specifically on housing. We really dived right into it, but like, maybe like the best thing we can do is follow like what you're building. So that's with Toronto Standard, right?
Toronto Standard is the firm name. TorontoStandard.co is the website. I'm also, as you know, active on Twitter where I like to post a lot of this stuff. So just Chris Spoke.
Thanks, Chris. Have a great afternoon and we'll talk to you soon.
Thanks for having me.
Cheers, mate. Right, that's it. We did it. 13 episodes all about how do we make Toronto the challenger city for Canada. We'll come out and I may have already posted some of the stuff by the time this is edited and up there, but this is where we need your help. Please like, share, send it to your counselor, send it to people who are invested in trying to make Toronto a better city. And let's turn this from not just more conversation into real working things that we can go do that make this city a better place to live, work and play. And maybe we'll come back and do another tranche of these episodes. Maybe we won't. But if you made it this far to the end of episode 13, thanks so much for listening. And let's make Toronto a challenger. Thanks. Bye-bye.